Hello, and welcome to the Oklahoma Atheists Godcast, the digital audio stream in which the members of the AOK are casting gods out, broadcasting our doubt, and casting about for answers to difficult questions. This week on the podcast, we're going to be doing our book review of Daryl Rae's The God Virus. And I have to say in advance, Daryl, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were going to listen to this, or I wouldn't have been so harsh. Don't take it personally, my criticisms apply to basically the entire field of memetics, not just you. I have grave doubt of using epidemiological concepts to apply to ideas unless we can somehow draw a bright distinction between harmful ideas and good ideas. But I get ahead of myself, we'll get to that here in the book club discussion, so enjoy.
Well, we usually start out with just what was your general impression of the book, so, Dave.
It was interesting. I really thought that he did go beyond Dawkins in The God Delusion. He had some interesting ideas. That was his intent. And he goes, into some detail on the progress and comparison to a disease process in the brain, whatnot. Damien?
I want to go last.
I want everyone to say all the positive stuff they have to say about the book first.
Well, I am in the middle. I have mixed emotions about it. I think the general idea of the virus analogy, which I can't remember whether it was Dawkins or Dennett who came up with it. I think one or the other, and he did a good job, I think, of elaborating their ideas. I don't think he said anything that was too surprising to me. There are things that I had already thought about myself, but he puts them in the virus metaphor. And it is, I think, a useful metaphor, but that's what it is. It's a metaphor or an analogy, and I think sometimes he gets carried away with it. I think that on the positive side, there's certainly... The term virus suggests pathology, and I have certainly seen examples of religious pathology. I can remember a 17-year-old kid telling me that he thought Satan had created him because he was gay, and he didn't remember ever choosing this identity, and certainly God could not have made him that way, so Satan must have. And he was just, here's this kid going through his life, racked with guilt and just self-loathing because somebody planted that idea, probably some well-meaning person planted that idea in him thinking, not the idea that Satan made him, but the idea that being gay was wrong and sinful in order to... help him have a better experience in the next life. And I remember thinking to myself, where is Richard Dawkins when you really need him in a situation like this? This kid is just unnecessarily going to live a miserable life as a result of this kind of idea. On the other hand, my basic gripe about the book is that he is, I think, way too broad in his and amorphous in his concept of a mem and of a virus. When he got to the point about free thinkers being, what did he say? He uses the analogy of I can't find the passage, but basically it's the idea that. Free thinkers are a mutation gone, are a viral mutation gone wild. I'm saying to myself, my God, do I have cancer? Yeah. And then he gets into other atheists.
Is that the part where he's talking about the Protestant Revolution and how it led to Enlightenment thinking?
Yeah. But he uses the analogy of mutations being out of control.
Right.
And he talks about other atheists. Well, he talks about non-theistic and atheist groups in this viral metaphor. Buddhism, for example, being described as at the time the most one of the most extensive God viruses in Asia.
Oh, and how is a mutation off of Hinduism?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He talks about communism. And uses an extended analogy to the God virus, and uses the term God virus with reference to Marxism-Leninism. And apparently Lenin was the God. And he goes on like that. I don't think it's useful to, I think, stretch things that far. I think it does violence to a speech to talk about an anti-God God virus. You know, atheist God viruses don't make any sense to me.
Well,
I certainly agree with the point that there are atheist movements like communism, and there are non-theistic religious movements like Buddhism, which have parallels to religion. But to call them God viruses, I think, is just... reminds me of what some of the progressive Protestant theologians do to the concept of God. You know, stretch it out, all out of shape, so that the ground of all being, Tillich's concept of God.
Right.
Yeah, if you want to define it that way, that's fine. But if you want to talk about anti-God God viruses, I guess that's your privilege. But I don't see that it's useful.
Well, I think that the whole idea of mutation is kind of... it's not apt.
Yeah.
Because when a genome undergoes a mutation, it's literally just a random change in the information.
Yes.
It's just like something goes wrong, there's a transposition error or whatever, and now the information is ordered differently. That is not how free thinkers arose out of the reading of the Bible that was engendered by the Protestant Reformation come out with the printing press.
Yeah.
What happened there is minds were processing information.
Mm-hmm.
There was not random change. People were thinking. And all these other mutations, like he talks about new sex splitting off as mutations of older sex, that it wasn't just random changes of information that made that happen. What happened is somebody read the doctrine of the old sect and said, well, I disagree, and here's what I think happened. Here's what I think the right doctrine should be. And so the idea of humans rethinking their position, which I think is a really good idea.
Right.
I think all free thinkers should be keen on critical thought and rethinking what you believe and trying to personally reformulate the creed that you got from whomever. To call that a mutation,
it's
not just disanalogous, it's kind of harmful to me. Because you're saying, because we all know most mutations are harmful and very few mutations are beneficial. So that part of the analogy really kind of bugs me, because it's...
Well, it would be an example of evolution, but evolution moves by multiple processes. There's mutation, and then there's also recombination.
Recombination of
ideas, which I think is more descriptive.
Wait, evolution works by recombination of ideas?
Apply the analogy.
Evolution of genetic creatures moves by recombination of genes.
Oh, you're talking about sexual recombination.
Yeah, sexual recombination.
Okay.
And evolution, in this case, of ideas would be new thinkers come along who combine new ideas differently in different ways that prove
that seems to be a better analogy.
That's a better analogy.
Yeah, right.
But again, the sexual recombination is a random process. Like every time you make a spermatozoa, a bunch of random, okay, we're going to pick out which bits of your, you're going to get half of your genome is put into every sperm at random. And it's a random process to which half of your genome is put into every single gamete. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's a lot.
There's not a deliberative process there at all. It's just literally just some of this, some of that.
I know, Damien, but there's a large characteristic of just the evolution of thought that has a lot of chance and a lot of accident to it. I mean, there is intentionality in it, but there's a lot of stuff that just happens by accident.
Like you meet some guy in a class or your uncle or whomever that happens to be think a different way, and then they impart certain ideas to you. I mean, there's chance involved in that. And I think just because there's some chance involved at some step that rules out.
And I'm not taking anything away from human agency or intentionality or anything, but I think that there is a lot of randomness about where we get some of our ideas, because we don't determine who we meet all the time, or the experiences that we have.
Well, that's why we have Bible colleges, so we know that we're going to meet exactly the right people, so we can stay within a circle of belief and not get mutations to our beliefs. I don't know. I have trouble with the analogy. I just
well, I kind of did too. I mean, I thought it sometimes, I sort of tired of the viral analogy, and I thought a lot, well, you could just leave this out. But I believe that what he's trying to do is sort of make this accessible. I'll just go next with my general impression. I think that he's trying to do is make this accessible to the average person that really doesn't know as much about religion as maybe you or especially their own religion or about atheist belief. And I think that the metaphor works for that, to that end. Maybe it doesn't work all in every aspect that we're talking about, but as far as making it accessible and something that someone can comprehend, I think that it sort of works in general. When I first began the book, I kind of understood why you didn't like it. I mean, I understand. I got.
Let the record show that he's looking at me.
Why Damien didn't like it. And when he sort of starts broadly, you know, talking about religion, much like Dawkins does and Christopher Hitchens, and he doesn't, I don't think he's as strong in his arguments at that point. But as it got to the middle and he began to look at individual actions and the effect that religion had on individuals and their emotions and their critical thinking, and he's sort of hit his stride with me, because I mean he is a psychologist, and so that you would anticipate this to be his strength, and I think that it proved true, and I did learn a lot, and a lot of things that I had never heard anybody say that I'd already always thought, and that they weren't like groundbreaking things, but they had never sort of been said, you know, that I think he makes clear, and I really, as the middle, towards the middle, I really got to liking it.
Could you give some examples?
Sure. Like, yeah. What are some of the best insights that you got from the book?
Okay.
Was it the guilt cycle part, or that's the one that I've heard a lot of people comment on positively.
This.
Yeah. What is that? The guilt cycle. Looks like it.
The religious guilt cycle. Yeah. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Which is what page is that? Just.
That's 90.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. You start with behavior. Go to guilt. Guilt creates tension. Tension creates behavior again. Then you feel guilty again. And then religious forgiveness or religion in general steps in as an intermediary to sort of take away some, to break the cycle for an instant, but it eventually leads you back to the same place. let me see. I've got quite a few things in mind. But like at the point where he was talking about communism, I did have that reaction you did, and I even wrote a kind of a scathing response to it in the back here, because I didn't feel like he had, I thought he was picking on communism, and I can see the parallels between just dogmatic thinking in general, whether you want to apply that to religious thinking, or whether you want to apply that to nationalism, whatever, I see that parallel, but he hadn't pointed out Manifest Destiny. Okay, for example. And I kind of got upset because it's real easy to pick on communists, right? But it's harder to look at Manifest Destiny. But eventually, after I wrote my little comment, I read on and he did. And I was glad of it. Because, I mean, that was completely religiously motivated.
My question is, what, if you apply the label to those phenomena...
The virus label?
Yeah, the virus label to those phenomena. All cultural beliefs are memes, and I guess if they have the additional characteristics that he describes as viral, you could use the same analogy to, for example, objectivism. That would be a similar deal to...
Or like really true and useful beliefs, like the germ theory.
Yeah.
Like wash your hands before you do surgery, or eat. And, like, these are really great ideas.
Yeah.
But I don't see how they don't fall under the viral metaphor.
Right.
Given how broadly he's construed it. You know, it, to me, like, we need to be able to differentiate between really good ideas that are evidence-based and bad ideas that have no evidence behind them. And I don't see how the viral metaphor helps us do that. If it, you know, because he would talk about how religious beliefs are something you can only catch from people who are in your immediate culture, in your vicinity.
Right.
Well, that's also true of germ theory.
Right.
That's also true of evolution. You can only catch good ideas from people in your immediate vicinity who are communicating them to you.
Well, I don't think that he's really that he's really taking this metaphor as seriously as you guys are taking it.
He wrote a book on it.
I understand that. I understand. But I don't think that he wants the reader to take it to that extreme. I think that it's just an easy aid for memorization and conception of what he's trying to say. But I don't think, or he would take it and he would stretch it out and elaborate more on it and try and make it fit. And it doesn't. I agree. I completely agree. Does it? But what I disagree is what his intentions are. And I think his intentions are just pedagogical. They're just to make this more easily accessible. Because I think it is. Another thing I like about the book is that it's very... If I were to pick two books for anybody to read that hadn't read anything on atheism, it would be this one and Hitchens... the one
God is not great?
God is not great. Because they're so opposite.
Really?
Where Hitchens is like, you know, he went here and he went here and I've been here. He's so worldly and he knows this stuff and
he's not trying to dumb
it
down
very,
at all.
Yeah, and you know he's very matter of fact. He's very frank about his beliefs. He's not afraid to attack anybody and tell them how stupid they are. And this guy seems a lot much more, you know, what's the word? Diplomatic about it. I mean, I don't see a lot of sarcasm.
Yeah.
He seems very like a psychologist. Like, he wants to not offend anybody, but he wants to get the information.
How could you not offend somebody by comparing their most cherished beliefs to a deadly pathogen?
This is just relative. I'm just using relative to Hitchens is what I'm saying. No, if I gave this to my sister, she would be extremely offended. I'm talking about the books that we have read.
As soon as she saw the cover.
As opposed to the books that we've read, though, I find this very tame. As far as that goes.
Yeah.
Which I think is okay because it does, again, make it more accessible to other people. And I taught a high school for 3 years, and I've been on textbook committees reviewing textbooks, math textbooks, English. This thing is set up like a textbook to me. It has those little summaries at the beginning. It has these little, you know, the quotes, the little inserts, which are very popular with textbooks now, where they have little nuggets of information for you to read.
And you notice his degree. EDD.
Yes, he's an EDD.
And I think that he did, I plan on asking him this at the thing, but I think that he may have done that for a reason. And I really think this is set up to be easily accessible, easily understood. I think that's why he uses the metaphor. It doesn't work in every instance. I don't buy it. I think he could have left it out. but I think overall, it's an important work for us as a movement.
Would you say that he's trying to indoctrinate people?
No.
Trying to spread his virus?
Yeah.
Well, I like the word ideology and the concept of ideology rather than I like the idea of virus. Because you can apply any kind of a need to, you know, not indoctrinate, but... Any need to explain your position, write a manifesto, for example, as ideology.
Right.
What we're doing here is promoting a certain kind of ideology.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, we just happen to know ours is right.
Right.
That's what they say. But
makes it a virus, doesn't it?
Yeah. But we have to focus on what is different from us. And that is this, we don't believe in anything. I mean, as far as gods go. Of course, we believe morality. But we're not preaching truth. I don't know who kept saying it. Was it Hitchens, I think? We're not promoting truth. We're promoting doubt, right? And that's the big difference. But overall, and towards the end, he gets into the sort of self-help for people who want to argue with
religion.
I could take it or leave it. It's fine.
What did you think about that? I thought it was somewhat controversial to say don't engage the virus. One of the missions of the Oklahoma Atheist is to engage the virus. We're here to help cure you of your religious infection.
I think I did. I've got a little section here where I made a couple of marks that I thought he made important.
I thought he made lots of important points. I just don't think that the points were in any way dependent upon the extended metaphor.
Right, right. Like I said, I think it turned into sort of a self-help book for people who want to argue with non-religious people. I mean, with religious people. But for example, when he says, and he puts this in bold, defensive people do not learn or change because they cannot listen. Right? And I know that, and we all know that, but you know how hard it is to stay calm when you're arguing with somebody about this. And I kind of know how important it is. But one of the things that I think we need to think about is that there's a difference between having passion about something and being angry about something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I get real passionate when I argue about something, which is misinterpreted a lot for anger, especially with my family.
It's just because you're a big scary guy.
That's part of it. No, that's part of it, because I get louder and more boisterous. But I don't see anything wrong with passion, because it's a good rhetorical device, and they damn sure use it. Because if you're watching two people arguing, you have no idea what they're talking about, and one of them's just, yeah, but, you know, and they seem very passionate about it, that will have an influence on whether you believe that person or not. It doesn't matter how critically you are aware of everything going on. And it does make a difference. And I do argue, you know, I can see what he's painting this picture of someone going, you know, getting around the subject of religion with someone who's you're going to get an inevitable fight about. But I think conflict is needed. It's unavoidable.
And I agree that, like, when you're at a funeral or something, that's not the time to be like, I don't want to hear your God talk. You know?
Right.
I mean, don't start a fight at a funeral, granted. But the idea that we should never engage the virus, that we should just engage the person and the person's feelings and all that, I think that has... It's good to be able to know how to do that and when to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know about you, but almost all the free thinkers I've met at some point were engaged. Somebody talked to them about whether their religion is true, and that's how they came to be free thinkers without any religious creeds or dogmas.
Mm-hmm.
It's because somebody took the trouble to engage them and to do an act which is considered socially unacceptable, to question their faith. And if nobody had done that for me, I'd still be an evangelical.
I've brought this up several times. I've told the story about whenever I came to, had the idea that there was no God, and I had never even thought about it, and someone just brought it up to me, you know, a friend. And I had sincerely never thought about that option before.
Really?
Of course, I argued with him at first. I said, what? No, there's got to be a God. There has to be.
The fool has said in his heart,
yeah,
there is no God.
But he just brought the idea. We didn't argue that, you know, passionately or whatever about it. We didn't get upset. But, yeah, from then on, it's like, well, hell, I never even thought about it. Let me start thinking about it.
Right.
So, I completely agree with you. There has to be something. Now, we can be civil, but I think that we can have passion. And I don't think we have to, you know, you handle people with kid gloves all the time. But we can be respectful and pick our battles. I mean, as he says in here.
I had a guy that first did that for me, too, when I was the guy that roomed next to me in college in the dorms there. He was the head of the Freethinkers Club on the campus, and so, of course, he was more than happy to engage in the subject. And that particular campus had a very evangelical culture to it, largely. Let me just say some of my favorite things about this book. I do want to say some positive stuff. I thought he made a lot of good points that are free of the metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned that if a Mormon and a Catholic were to debate the merits of their respective religions, neither could see his own inconsistencies or fallacies, but each would see the others quite clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you need the viral metaphor to see that that's the case. It's real easy for an evangelical to say, you know, Mormon archaeology and history about North America is just silly. You can't see that, you know? Anyone can see that if they're not a Mormon. That's all it takes, is to not be told from when you're a little kid to believe the story, and then you're good.
Just this week, PBS had a series on religions. I know they did Mormonism and Buddhism, and they might have done other religions on other nights. But they talk about that very issue, about how the Mormon Church has financed a lot of archaeology in North America in an attempt to prove the veracity of their so-called scriptures, and they've been forced to come back empty-handed every time, because every time they went and looked for some of the evidence that the books claim should be there, it's not.
Right. It's been a very defensive industry, Mormon archaeology. Yeah, but they keep trying. They're going to. It's like people keep looking for the Ark.
Yeah.
Not the Ark
of
the Covenant, the other Ark, the floaty one.
I like the fact that he's examining what makes people susceptible to religious infection. And I've been waiting on someone to talk about this from the books. I mean, the only atheist books I've ever read are what we've read. Okay?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I can't, you know, I'm not well-versed.
You got here on your own, did you?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
But on page 164, when he talks about the three types of people who are infected. It's 164, about the middle of the page.
Could you give me an exact quote? I don't have page number.
Religions that promise salvation from eternal damnation may tend to more easily hook fearful or worrying type of people. People who reject fear-based tactics.
I got it.
May find, I'm at the, you got that, religions that promise?
Right.
Okay.
People who reject fear-based tactics may find New Age religions or the Quakers.
Uh-huh.
Right on.
Yes. Reincarnation, becoming one with God are attractive hooks to people who are looking for positive affirmation. So you've got religions, people looking for salvation from eternal damnation, who are naturally fearful or worrying people, for example, one kind. Or you have someone who's looking for affirmation, positive affirmation. Mm-hmm. Or the third one, the Fundamentalist Church seem to attract people who have strong need for right and wrong, good, bad, black, white approaches, which I think describes a lot of people.
And these are all really good points. None of them are dependent at all on the viral metaphor. This is just proof points about psychology, right?
Right. That's what I say. I think that he's hitting his stride right here. I'm pointing. Let it be known I'm pointing in the middle of the book.
My question is, and I think another one is a search for meaning. They want something to kind of tie their lives together or to give their lives meaning, a sense that there is a, I don't know whether purpose is the right word, but that it's not just a series of day-to-day, one thing after another. And I guess that's another one of my problems with his book. What does a person look like who doesn't have any of those things? I mean, who is not infected with the virus?
A virus or just
one? Any virus, and is not does not have one of these MEMS that.
Right.
That,
well,
I mean, what
would they be really boring, right?
Yeah. What is that person like? Just kind of goes along day to day,
man. Well,
whatever.
Well, somebody that doesn't have a political ideology,
yeah,
a religious ideology.
Yeah.
Someone who's like. Doesn't read any manifestos.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't do that.
And are these people good? Is that what we're aiming for?
I think the idea of a meme is simply a self-replicating artifact of human thought that passes from person to person.
Right.
And we all have them.
And those are just the nature of the information that we pass back and forth to with each other through conversation or writing or drawings or however it is that we communicate.
And the important insight from memetics, I think, the vital insight from memetics is that there's memes that keep replicating because they're just damn useful. Internal combustion engine, how to build those sort of memes, germ theory sort of memes, these insights about the way the world really works, those are going to replicate because they're just so darn useful.
Well, they're scientific.
And politicalized.
But there's also,
justice, democracy.
Yeah, like one man, one vote. Slavery is bad. That's a meme. But it's also true in a way that slavery does not promote general human happiness. And then
for some people, for the slaves, no.
When I say general, I mean general.
But I'm just pointing out that there's a difference between scientific memes or whatever your ideas and then human generated ideas, which are always the more problematic.
What kind of human?
I'm talking about generated. Democracy, something that's human.
Truth about psychology or ethics or politics, that sort of thing? Mm-hmm.
Something that's part of a discourse, not the scientific discourse.
And what were you saying about
it? I was drawing a distinction between them, because it's always more problematic when you're dealing with something that's...
They're more controversial, but at the same time...
Because we create them,
right? Yeah, let me finish my distinction here. There's memes over here that are useful, like germ theory and democracy. And then there's memes over here and this is the central insight of memetics. Some ideas replicate just because they're good at replicating.
Yeah.
They're engineered so as to replicate themselves. Ideas like, if you don't believe in this dogma, you will go to hell.
Yeah.
You get a kid implanted with that dogma, and they're going to believe it and pass it on because it's just freaking scary. And they don't pass it on because it's true or useful. It doesn't do anything good for the kid. It's probably harmful. But it's well-engineered to be passed on. And so I want a sharp line drawn between ideas which are useful and true and ideas which are well-designed to replicate and don't have any utility.
Right.
And I don't get the sense that this book is trying to do that. That's the line that I want to draw. I want to be able to say, here's the ideas that are just well-engineered replicators with no utility or negative utility, and here are the ideas that replicate because they're helping us. They're spreading in the human minds because they're doing good things for humans. That's the line I want to draw. And maybe the book does that somewhere I didn't see it.
Well, I'm not sure. There's all kinds of memes with varying degrees of utility or malignancy, and I think that there are memes that may be like genes, which in one environment are useful and in another environment are hostile, are malignant. I mean, specifically, you can compare it to the gene, which on the one hand makes you more susceptible to sickle cell anemia, but on the other hand protects you from malaria.
Right.
That's the one that, you know, so many people from Africa have. And I mean, there can be genes that are good in one environment. I mean, memes that are good in one environment and harmful in another environment. I mean,
right.
The meme,
slaves submit to your masters, as in Christ. That's a meme directly from the New Testament. In one environment, it's good to go ahead and follow that because otherwise you're going to be beaten and possibly killed. In another environment, it's just a bad idea to have slavery at all.
It's the kind of a meme that an authoritarian government would like to have floating about in the culture.
But my point is, I would easily, there's some memes where I'd say, okay, that meme is good in this environment where slavery is the norm, but slavery as a meme is a bad idea. So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of like those fundamentalists who like to have everything right, wrong, good, bad, black, white, that you were just talking about on that page.
Mm-hmm.
I want to bend these memes into useful and not useful. It's important to me that we move forward toward the more useful ideas, like, you know, women don't need to cover themselves head to toe. And away from the older traditional ideas like women must cover themselves head to toe or they dishonor their family and should be burned to death.
I'd like to say that this out of the books that we have read, I would be more inclined to recommend to some of my religious friends and family members to read, because I think he explicitly states that he's writing this not just for atheists but for people who might be questioning. He wants them to question their own beliefs and to examine them from a psychological point of view. He says, I think he makes an interesting point where he's talking about how religions change with the culture and it's not the other way around, which I think is a point that we need to drive home more and more to religious people, because they all know it, but they don't like to admit it. They don't like to admit that their church got the big screen jumbotron and is moving along with society and with culture and has changed its belief from even 50, 60 years ago. They're very uncomfortable with it and they like to repress that knowledge, but I think it's something we need to always drive home.
Could you give us a quote on that? So pop it up here.
Well, morality is defined in terms of current culture, of the current culture.
Thank you.
The virus tends to follow along and intervene only when its survival is threatened. Since culture is constantly shifting, the God virus is always trying to position itself for survival within the culture. That might be an example of some of the things that all know.
But that's wrong, though. Like, the God virus is not always trying to do that. Oftentimes, the God virus is rebelling fairly actively against what the current culture is doing. The current culture is saying, women, it's okay to take the pill, and men, it's okay to wear condoms and have gay sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go forth and have fun, just be safe about it. The culture is saying these things, and if I remember my upbringing correctly, the church culture is saying, no, we got to go back to the Bronze Age sexuality. We can't have all this new women's liber and, free love ethos. We can't just have people being safe and responsible about sex. We have to go back to the Bronze Age and say, one vagina for you for the rest of your life, and that's the way it's got to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe that's a good idea for me personally, but I'm going to have to bleep on you know what I'm saying.
I completely understand.
I would say that churches are very often highly countercultural, and they're not trying to adapt to the modern ethos. They're trying to drag us back into the Bronze Age.
Right, I understand what you're saying. And he makes that distinction between the two. You have churches, and he's shown how religion and religious beliefs, even 100 years ago, or 150 years ago, who advocated slavery. He talks about the separation between the beginning of the Southern Baptist Church, for example, was over slavery, and how that no longer applies. And he makes some pretty good points about how religion has changed to meet the demands of the culture. But you're completely right.
But it was kicking and screaming the whole way.
Right.
In fact, the Southern Baptists apologized for slavery, like, what, last year?
Yeah. And then the Catholic Church with Nazis in World War II. But the point is that even though they're screaming and kicking, that's fine. The point is that they have changed with the culture, and that that's something that we need to point out to
only
them.
When they absolutely have to.
That's fine. But they always want to isolate themselves. It's always a fear of the world, right? They would say that, the contemporary world, the modern world, coming and encroaching in, and that's always dramatized in smaller towns, where it's not only big town ideas, but it's big town technology and these things. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, movies who come into small towns and going to corrupt our youth and all that. It's always a sense of isolationism. You're exactly right. But they do move along. You know, the mega church is moving along.
But in
evangelical.
In some ways. But they did eventually admit that slavery was a bad idea, like 100 years after we'd fought a pretty bloody war over the issue. And they did eventually admit that maybe women can be kind of equal to men, but not all churches have really admitted that yet. Not the one I grew up in. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, they don't just lag the culture by 10 or 20 years. They lag the culture by quite a bit. And I think there's a stronger case to be made that they're holding us back than that they're readily adapting. Some, I guess,
preaching to the choir, man. I completely agree. But we can't sit here and let them think, as he says, that morality has never changed. It's always the same. It's always been the same Bible. We can't let them ride on that.
Right. Traditional marriage.
Yeah,
it's always been the same thing.
You have changed, and they are holding us back. But we got to call them on that every chance, because they'll ignore it, and they won't bring it up. And they'll tell everybody, their new infected people, that it's always been the same. And those people don't know. They don't understand what the hell the history of their religion, or probably the history of the United States.
And I'm sure that, like, some Protestant denominations are going to be, some mainline Protestant denominations are going to be more and more gay-friendly. Mm-hmm. But my guess is some of them will always, you know, hold back. And I mean, and it'll take them quite a long time before, you know, Southern Baptist churches didn't accept black congregants for a long time after they lost that battle culturally. And integration was already well underway in the wider society.
Mm-hmm. Anything that points out their hypocrisy is golden to me. I love to do that. They should always be reminded in the contradictions of their beliefs.
Is it hypocrisy? I mean, if they're pointing to their holy book and saying, we should follow this, that's not hypocrisy, that's consistency. It's just that it's a really old, out-of-date book.
It's a hypocrisy to change it.
Oh. But that's good hypocrisy. I want them to change it.
Yeah, I want them to change it too, but I want them to change to completely not ever believing this in the first place.
I'm just saying that there's a certain hypocrisy in ignoring parts of the Bible. Like when you ignore the part that says you should stone people for adultery or whatever other biblical parts you're writing off. But that to me is the positive hypocrisy. You're putting morality first and consistency with your holy book second.
Yeah,
that's what I want.
You're putting the culture that you're within first, because you have to survive. It's like you can't kill, to use this metaphor, you can't kill the host completely, because you're riding along with the host. If you're the virus.
Oh,
okay.
You brought in the metaphor successfully.
I brought in the metaphor. I told you it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
You can't kill culture, and they don't want to. But although they seem like they want to take it over, I think on some level they understand how they could make it all go down the crapper. I mean, but I'll give you an example. On page 86, this is something I liked about the book, too. double messages in religion. I thought this was really good. I liked this. You can see that he's experienced a lot of the same things that we've experienced with religion. And he gives this entire list of contradictions that religious people make in their arguments.
For Kindle readers, it's on page 1417.
And we've heard most of these either from other books or from, we've thought them in our own minds when we hear the bullshit. The first one, God loves you, but he will send you to hell if you do not do exactly as he says.
God loves you and gave you an intelligent brain to see and understand his creation, but you will be condemned for asking the wrong question.
God loves you. He loves all Christians. He hates Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and all those who deny him. And the wonderful analogy he gave about his grandmother, who used to sing that
that little song to him about, how's it go? Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, right? And then...
I joined in, but I don't remember the tunes.
They are precious in his sight. Jesus loves all the little children of the world. But then when they allowed the black kids to come swim in the public pool, the black kids,
yeah, yeah.
She got all pissed off. I mean, that kind of stuff, that's just the epitome of it right there. I mean, I can see that and just, you know, where I'm from, that would be a contradiction that would not have come up to the surface of the average conscious mind in from where I'm from. They would have accepted that
segregation was just seen as a norm back then?
Huh? Yeah.
Because segregation was just seen as the norm.
Like, not back then.
But
I mean...
We're still in Oklahoma.
That's what we have to continually do, is to say, look what you're saying and look what you're doing.
Right.
I mean, I'm not trying to paint myself as beyond hypocrisy. I'm not. But I'm not going to commit that kind of atrocious hypocrisy. I mean, I contradict myself. Damn. That's horrible. And to teach a child
that.
Well,
Jesus loves the little children, all the little children, but not all in the same pool. I mean, it doesn't say they should swim together.
Oh, I'm going to bleep that out.
But all of those that he lists, I think are really good. They're good things to point out.
And none of them are dependent on the analogy.
You know, however, I guess... I think you really need to be careful using the term virus in the language of pathology in describing such a wide variety of beliefs. I think, as he says, there's a tendency to see how all the other ones, but the one that you hold, are pathological. And I think we do have to ask the question, well, what does the non-viral belief look like?
Well, there are good viruses and bad viruses, or good bacteria and bacteria, right? I mean, we have those,
I guess so.
Bacteria in our guts who have a symbiotic relationship with us. But yeah,
you yourself are a colony of cooperating cells.
That's right. Okay.
Controlled by a genetic coding mechanism.
I think that, again, I'll go back to this metaphor. I think it was just a market. I think it's a sexy title.
Yeah,
like it's the God virus. Right?
I would have less trouble with it if he talked about the religious virus, because things like communism, things like objectivism, and so on have quasi religious aspects. The analogy I think is useful in pointing some of those out, but when you use the term the God virus to describe a belief system
that doesn't depend on God,
not only doesn't, but adamantly rejects it, says that there is no God. You know, that's a little, that seems to be stretching it a little bit. And Lenin wasn't really ever viewed by anybody as a God, the way we usually use the term God. He wasn't supernatural, was not regarded. Well, they didn't think that if they went to his tomb, he would heal their palsy or something.
Yeah, I think that he mentions communism so much because it's used as an attack on atheists a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you always hear, well, what about these atheist regimes? They're better than religious people about killing and genocide and all that stuff. I think there was probably a certain amount of pressure to use communism and throw it in and lump it in into this dogmatic way of seeing.
And that's exactly what I suspect, that he uses that as a way of insulating his own beliefs against the charge that, well, atheists have been guilty of violence too. Well, they weren't really atheists. They were infected by the God virus.
They were infected by something, right? Yeah. I mean, Marxism...
Bad meme virus.
Yeah,
I would say Marxism is a faith. It's not a God virus, but it certainly takes a lot of faith to believe.
It's absolutely different from nationalism.
I think it's quasi-religious. You could call it
quasi-religious. It's worse than nationalism. Yeah.
Well, yes, that's the whole point. I mean, when Lenin and Stalin, when the communists took over Russia, I mean, that was they basically tried to assume the place that the Russian Orthodox Church had occupied previously. I mean, they demolished the churches. They were basically a faith-based organization. People weren't allowed to question communism. If you did, you were sent to the camps, or work in some hellish existence till you died. And so that wasn't, they were not, the communists and the communist regime were not about critical thinking and
right.
questioning authority. They were all about imposing authority on from above,
right.
essentially a faith-based secular society.
And unfortunately, they used the concepts of, atheism was incorporated into their belief system and science. It was scientific socialism.
It wasn't very good scientific.
Not science the way we think of it, but pseudoscience.
What?
I think it's fair to say that their agricultural program wasn't really that scientific.
I'm just trying to draw a distinction between religion, religious belief and proof, and what someone like Marx or Freud was trying to do through what I consider to be, whether you want to call it scientific method or philosophical or metaphysical method. They had a specific method that they were trying to use, using logic to predict what was going to happen. And that is not what religion is about. And that's kind of the problem I had with him warping that in with the metaphor, which I'm agreeing.
And what you're talking about is essentially what I do. In developing my views of reality, I'm not in the business of generating a bunch of hypotheses that I proceed to subject to tests. I fly by the seat of my pants, go on the basis of inference from my experience, from what I read, from what I see, and see patterns. Am I going to vote for McCain or Obama?
You don't ask God who to vote for.
No, but on the other hand, there's no way of really coming to a scientific conclusion, but I trust my, and everybody else trusts their judgment and comes to conclusions that are often exactly the opposite of mine. But the best I can do is to read as much as I can and think as much as I can and make decisions. But I wouldn't say that it's scientific, and I certainly would not say that, therefore, I am, because I've come to this conclusion, I am right and infallible. I try to keep an open mind,
but
see what somebody else has to say.
But you're going through the critical thinking process.
Yeah.
And what he's trying to say is that most religious people, the virus keeps them from doing that.
That's right.
It stops all critical thinking.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that also true of political ideologues to some extent? And some, I mean, I'm not saying that all political ideologies discourage critical thought, but certainly Stalinism did, and Maoism and Kimism. They say just believe in the dear leader. And as to massive controlled experiments, I can think of two. North and South Korea, East and West Germany.
Yeah.
Two massive experiments where we took a people who all spoke the same language and came from the same cultural background, cut them in half and said, you guys have free markets, you guys have a dear leader. And see how it turned out. I think we have the results in now.
Well, to me, this whole thing is not just about religion. It is about reaction against any kind of dogmatic thinking that stops critical thinking or questioning of authority. And that could be in the form of political movements, but most obviously it's in the form of religion.
And let's face it, it can't be in the form of atheism.
Sure.
And not just Stalinism, but there are atheists who just cannot abide anybody entertaining the idea that there could possibly that be anything to question.
We can't prove there's not a God.
Yeah.
Not sure if I agree with that.
You never agree with anything.
I think if you define God narrowly enough, you can do some pretty impressive evidential arguments against him. And
even if it was just a force of some nature.
I'm just saying, if there was an all-powerful being, if there was, see, that's not what I'm getting at. If there was a God who was incredibly powerful, very all-powerful or almighty, and wanted everyone to know about him and his fatherhood of humanity and his son who died for humanity, then we'd all know, because an all-powerful being could let us all know. And so it's fair to assume that
he wants us to find out for ourselves, and if we don't, we're in big trouble.
Right,
or don't,
but
we don't believe enough.
You've just posited a different God than the one I was talking about. Yeah. The one that I was talking about wants us all to know. And so what I'm saying is you cannot affirm the existence of a God who really wants us to know.
Right.
You can affirm the existence of a God who kind of wants us to know, but it's not really the biggest priority that he has.
Well, I think it's pretty good. I think it's
Yeah, that's a pretty good read.
I think it's good for what it is. It's not Hitchens, and I love. But if I were going to tell people, I'd tell them to read Hitchens in this. This would be a good primer for anybody who's interested, I think, to somebody who's never really thought about it before. I think it's a good introduction. I agree with the metaphor thing. I think you just left it out.
I'm afraid that, yeah, the overextension of the metaphor would give somebody a reason to just reject the whole thing. Even the really good points that he makes, which have nothing to do with the metaphor.
They'd get stuck on that.
Because
it'd give them an excuse to disagree
with it. What kind of nonsense?
If I couldn't get past it and I wanted this to be a good book, imagine if you came into the book defensive from the get-go.
We got to start reaching out, though. I mean, I think it's up. And you said this is a very popular, from what you told me about the responses you read on Amazon.
But that was the choir. That was the choir, the proverbial choir to whom Ray was preaching. Those are all like the atheist-friendly people saying, this is a great book.
But I think that I can see where this would be pretty popular. Because it has a broad appeal.
Let's run an experiment. Let's each give a copy to one of our theistic friends and see what they think.
Okay. The psychological aspect of this, and he gets to talking about individuals, and I think is where he does a really good job. And I have read none. I had never seen that extended as much as I had in this one. I appreciated that a lot. Now, as I said in the beginning, I don't think he does as good as, say, Hitchens or Dawkins on looking the broader reality of religion, but I don't think that's what he should be doing. I think he should be doing exactly what he did towards the middle. He is a psychologist, and a lot of stuff I've never heard of before.
You know, something else, as long as I'm bitching, if you look at the cover, you get the sense going in that he's going to show you how all these different religions have certain mimetic features in common.
Yeah.
Look at the bottom.
Yeah. I would have stuck those inside here, wouldn't you?
Sure. But that's not the point. How many of those symbols did he actually talk about? I'd say three. And so I think, I'm not going to say false advertising in the sense that you're liable for it, but I mean, it was kind of like annoying because I was hoping he'd really say, oh, now look at this part of like how viruses are catchy, religions are catchy. And then he would talk about a whole bunch of like, you know, in the Rig Veda, blah, blah, blah. But he didn't do that. He basically just focused on the part of religion that I already know about because I grew up here in Oklahoma.
And what do you think about the idea of the Buddhist God virus? I mean, what is Buddhism something that we should be leery of and opposed to and thinking that it's, well, because I know some atheists claim Buddhism. I've seen atheist sites, you know, where we have humanism and
Buddhism is a very flexible belief system.
Yeah.
Classical Buddhism includes the supernatural, but Buddhist practices have been refined to, you know, a set of behaviors, a set of things you can learn, practices that you can learn, which are not theistic.
Yeah.
I know a few non-theistic Buddhists who came from Southeast Asia or converted to, like, Zazen meditation practices.
I have friends who are really into Buddhism who are absolutely convinced that it's the way.
You friends with Richard Gere?
We've lost a couple members of the atheist group to Buddhism, but not like lost them. They're just really into meditating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so is Harris. He is very much into Buddhism.
I'm all for, you know, whatever practice helps people clear their head.
Yeah.
Personally,
about religion? What if religion would help me clear my head? What would you say?
Well, what is the harm in that? It depends on what other things it does to you.
Yeah.
Suppose that you go to Mayflower UCC, right, where they teach you to love your neighbor, be good to people, try to work for social justice and civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
What is the harm in that?
Or Quakers.
Or exactly. Like,
Quakers don't hurt people.
Well, they're Methodists like that, too. I mean, take their religion. They are really not into this hard-line stuff, but they believe in doing good and being, you know, getting involved in social causes and so on. So I guess I have the same question. What's the harm in that?
Well, I have a mixed marriage.
Oh.
My wife is a supernatural believer. She goes to a Methodist church, but she's not really into the whole Christian line. She just believes there's a personal God that you can pray to that will maybe intervene every now and then in some little way. And so, you know, Sam Harris makes this big issue about, oh, well, those considered,
yes,
you know, moderately, you know, supernatural believer people, they're just making it possible for the extremists on the right to exist, or on, you know, the religious extremists to exist. And
I see how.
I think it's just as much the other way. They make it possible for us to be over here on our side. They're just, because not everyone's mind moves in that black and white way. People,
right.
I mean, think about all of the different ideas you've held at various times in your life, all the different possibilities you have entertained, and say, well, you know, that might be true. And you get into it for a while, and after a while you think either you get bored with it or you think, no, that's just not true. And you move on. And yet they're just going through the same processes with their lives that you and I have gone through in our lives. And you know, everyone's just got to have time to change their own pace. Of course, sometimes if people get guns and they come out and they say, you know, we want you to change now, you might have to resist them, that kind of thing. So we might have
or
try to change their mind. Or
strap bombs to themselves before they change.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, but I don't have so much of a problem with the moderate religionist people. I happen to live with one, you know.
Yeah.
the argument, and this has, I think, almost nothing to do with this, with Bray's book, the argument is that if you're a moderate believer in any religion, that you take certain propositions on faith from an ancient holy book. And then the extremists come along and say, oh yeah, we take that same book way more seriously than you do. We're going to go ahead and kill the gays, because that's what it says in the book. And so there's no good moderate response to that, because what the moderates have to do at that point is say, well, you're only supposed to take these parts of the Holy Book seriously. You're not supposed to go all the way back to that part there, or that part there in Romans 1 that talks about how terrible the lesbians are. And I think moderate believers, when it comes to a Holy Book, are in a really awkward position. They want to say, love thy neighbor, and extend it as far as they can, but the book has all this really anti-loving stuff in it, so what are they going to do?
I tell you, you're going to have to get right then on, because when he gets through with his argument, these moderate believers are the true believers, and these other ones are worshiping a false god. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to hear him make that argument.
He does.
To me, if you're going to say this is a holy book.
And that book is not supposed to be, is not a non-errant book, and not to be taken literally.
If it's not inerrant, then you're going to have trouble believing the whale stories and the zombies rising stories. Like, the thing is, if you're going to believe that God sent his son, or whatever the real wacky miracles are, you kind of have to believe that the whole book is ridiculously credible to get over that bar of rising from the dead, which seems kind of unusual. Not a whole lot of reported cases of that. And that's why the inerrantists are inerrantists, because they say the whole thing is absolutely right. Because otherwise you start picking and choosing, saying, well, maybe Jonah wasn't really in a whale. You know, maybe the healings really were like Bishop Spong sees them as metaphors for an acceptance. I accept you and your epilepsy. I don't really cast demons out of you, but I'll give you a hug.
Yeah.
You know, and that's different. Sorry, I've gotten off the book.
Well,
do we want to talk about anything else in the book? So I can
finished.
Stop recording.
I'm finished.
This podcast is a production of the Oklahoma Atheist, an organization dedicated to developing a community of like-minded individuals who share the ideas of free and critical thinking, and as opposed to the uncritical acceptance of faith-based ideas and norms. Our activities include dinner meetups, potlucks, family outings, debates, speeches, book clubs, volunteer opportunities, and political events and protests. We welcome all who share the ideals of critical thinking and who reject religious dogma. In addition to cultivating a community, we wish to contribute and put a face with all positive things non-believers and people with a secular viewpoint are doing in the world. If you'd like to know more, please visit us online at www.oklahomaatheist.com.